You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including state test scores, a Humboldt County case that could go to the Supreme Court, and a new mental health program for teens. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And reporter Roman Battaglia is out in the field today, but we'll start with this conversation we recorded with him earlier this week. Roman, you took over Jane's education beat this week to report on the release of statewide test results for Oregon schools. First, what are these tests?
So these are statewide assessments that are taken every spring. So the results that we have now are from the 2024 to 2025 school year. So students in 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 11th grade.
They get a little break in there.
Yes, you get a little bit of break in high school, but they all take these tests. You're tested in English, math, and science. There's four scores you can get, or four categories. You get a score of 1 to 4. 1 to 2 means you're not proficient in that subject, and 3 to 4 means you are. So when we talk about the percentage of students proficient, we're talking about the students who scored a 3 or a 4.
So it's kind of like a GPA almost.
Yeah, sort of. But the state does note that, you know, 3 to 4 does mean you're proficient, but that's partly because that's like what the federal government says you would be proficient in. You know, a 2 does mean they are still at a grade level performance, but you're just not doing good enough to be considered proficient. You're not accurate or complex enough in the reasoning on the state test.
Okay. Well, what did these results tell us about school performance statewide?
You know, it's not amazing. The Oregon Department of Education said that they're not happy with the results. I mean, they're not great. This was the first year that overall scores improved across all three subjects since testing resumed in 2021 after the pandemic. But, those scores are still below the pre-pandemic levels, and Oregon is not doing great generally nationwide either. In English, you know, just over 50% of the students statewide were testing as proficient before the pandemic, but this year they're still at about 40%. And it's about the same story for science and math, although overall proficiency is lower in general there. There were also some improvements in participation rates on the test. The state struggles with participation rates because there's a state law that allows parents to opt their children out of the English and math tests. And so that means the state has not been able to meet this 95% participation rate that's required federally.
Well, what about when we take a step back and just look at Southern Oregon?
Southern Oregon specifically, I looked at the data for the region. They're still kind of lagging behind the statewide average on these scores. Southern Oregon was still lagging behind before the pandemic. But, you know, there were some good improvements in English and math. Science scores did drop overall, but, you know, that really kind of depends on the district, too. Some districts did a lot better than others. The Ashland School District in particular, I think, scores the highest on all three categories. You know, it's kind of hard to tell what the magic trick is for improving those scores. I talked to some districts. Klamath County attributes it to a refocus on their academic rigor after the pandemic. Central Point said it was because of this consulting firm that helped to bring in teachers across the district and coordinate their learning because they have a lot of students who move between different schools during the middle of the school year. So, you know, it kind of depends. There's different tricks that schools have done to improve their outcomes.
What are some of the challenges school districts are facing as they continue to recover from the pandemic?
Yeah, from the school districts I talked to, it sounds like attendance is a big issue still. In some places, attendance is continuing to drop since the pandemic.
Wow.
And that can have a big impact on student outcomes. I talked to Trisha Evans at the Grants Pass School District, and she told me that right now only 68% of their students attend school regularly, which is down from 85% pre-pandemic.
When you're not present for that social-emotional learning piece and able to process your thinking, you're not going to be able to reach the depth of knowledge expected on state assessments.
So, you know, the Oregon Department of Education showed us an interesting correlation related to this. this week based on surveys of students that they do not related to the tests. Seventh graders who were more likely to talk with the whole class about math problems were more likely to score proficient on their state math test. So it sort of shows you that, you know, when these students are in class and making these connections with students and talking about their problems and stuff, they, you know, are more likely to score better on those state tests. Attendance is a problem at other schools too. I also, you know, from what I heard, funding is an issue. Having enough funding and time for the individualized learning that these students lead, a lot more students need, you know, more personalized intervention than they have in the past. So that's also, you know, an issue for these schools, is there's just not enough time.
Well, what is the state doing to help improve student performance?
Yeah, they're working on, you know, there's this new focus on early literacy that the governor has kind of prioritized, and so they're hoping that will help. There's also this year, the state funding that the state approved for schools comes with this new accountability program attached, and that should help with struggling schools especially. They're going to, you know, the state will be able to step in and consult or have control over some of their finances. The school districts I talked to were happy about grants that have been available from the state for different programs, but they're also kind of concerned that, you know, maintaining that funding once they start doing well is hard. Once they start to do better on those test results, then the funding kind of dries up, so it makes it harder to keep that going.
That was JPR's Roman Battaglia. Justin, you had a story about a petition to the Supreme Court out of Humboldt County. Tell us, what is this petition about?
Yeah, so this has to do with a class action lawsuit by residents against the county for cannabis-related fines. So basically, these residents were stuck with some pretty big fines as part of the county's code enforcement program targeting illegal marijuana grows there, which there are a lot of in Humboldt County. And some of these property owners faced, you know, thousands of dollars per day, actually, because the county had accused them of growing cannabis illegally. And they argue in this lawsuit that there's a lot of issues with the county's program here. For one, they claim they weren't growing cannabis illegally or at all in some cases. You know, they say the county has relied on old satellite images and drone footage, never visited their property, just assumed, you know, if they saw a greenhouse, for example, on a property, that that person is growing cannabis and that they can start fining them. Another issue is that they claim the county waited for them to buy the property, which might have had code violations they didn't know about before they charged them, because, you know, now someone was living at the property. And so they claim the county thought they might have a chance at actually collecting these fines. So they would wait for a property owner to actually purchase a piece of land there. So there's a lot of potential issues there, and this case is currently in federal court. But due to precedent set more than 100 years ago, actually, that federal court didn't allow a challenge to the fines on Seventh Amendment grounds. And so it's that part, that Seventh Amendment case, which they want to take up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, it's been a while since civics class. Remind us, what does the Seventh Amendment say?
The Seventh Amendment includes your right to a jury trial, so it's pretty important. But this amendment of the Constitution doesn't apply yet to civil local government cases, like in the case of fines in Humboldt County. So there's this kind of important legal concept called incorporation, and that's the process where the Supreme Court has applied the Bill of Rights to states and local governments. This wasn't, you know, automatic. I kind of thought it was. This has been a long process. You know, just in 2019, the Supreme Court incorporated the Eighth Amendment protection against excessive fines. So now that applies to states and local governments. But the Seventh Amendment is one of the last amendments that hasn't been incorporated, and attorneys representing these Humboldt County residents think this is a great opportunity to do that.
So why would a jury trial be important in a case like this?
Well, they argue they aren't able to get a fair treatment by the county without a jury. So they want to fight these fines. You know, they want to argue their case and say, we weren't the ones growing marijuana. Your information is old. But right now, the person hearing their case would be a judge hired by the county. It's not an elected position or anything. It's just someone taken from the private sector, which the county hires. So they don't think they'll get a fair hearing, especially with millions of dollars at stake potentially for the county. There's just incentives there that, you know, wouldn't require people to be impartial.
And so do we know when the Supreme Court will make a decision on this?
The court will release information next week on what petitions they'll hear, and it has several likely options. So it could deny the petition, decide not to hear it, the precedent currently would stand. It could delay making a decision on whether to hear the case, just kind of kick the can down the road, or it could accept the petition and then schedule oral arguments for the case. And so we'll be following what the court says next week on this.
Okay, thank you, Justin. Jane, you're working on a story about a new mental health program coming to Oregon and California this fall. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So it's called the Youth Mental Health Corps. It launched last year, actually. It's sort of a national organization that is partnering with AmeriCorps, and they receive basically a lot of philanthropic funding to make it all work. But the goal of this organization is sort of twofold. So number one is improving youth mental health, which we know has not been doing well. And number two is addressing a workforce shortage in the field of mental and behavioral health. And so this Youth Mental Health Corps is now expanding into Oregon and California this fall.
And how does a youth mental health corps actually work?
So they hire young adults, so that's 18 to 24-year-olds, and then basically send them into health clinics and schools and nonprofits. And the goal is to help middle and high schoolers who need mental health support. So the goal is to sort of meet communities' short-term needs. You know, middle and high schoolers are struggling. They don't have enough providers for these types of services. And then also provide a sort of long-term workforce in this industry. So the core participants, the young people who are going into the schools, receive a stipend for their work, they receive mentorship, they get a bunch of training, they get experience working in the field, they're working towards their behavioral health credentials. So the hope is that they then pursue a career in this field and, like I said, create that long-term workforce for the behavioral and mental health industry. And they also really say that it's important that it's young people that are working with these younger people. So they're almost peers, right? 18 to 24-year-olds helping middle schoolers and
high
schoolers.
They're not old and uncool like us.
Exactly. So they can sort of help build trust with the young people. They're trying to reduce the stigma of asking for help, helping these kids navigate, connect them with resources. And so that's sort of the goal of what this program is trying to do.
And where will this Youth Mental Health Corps be sent?
So in our region, they'll be in Arcata. The partner organization there is Cal Poly Humboldt, and they'll be sent into local schools throughout Arcata. And then also be in Chiloquin. The partner organization there is called The Stronghold. It's a nonprofit there that's really focused on culturally responsive peer support, helping people with mental health issues or struggling with substance abuse in recovery. And so the locations of where exactly the core members will be sent there has yet to be determined, but they're still working on that. But these are areas that are, you know, more rural. They have higher need for this behavioral health support. So last year, this Youth Mental Health Corps was in 4 states. This school year, they're expanding into 7 more states with 600 young adults. And then they're planning to expand into 7 more states next fall. So it keeps growing.
Well, thank you so much, Jane. And you were just actually talking about supporting young people. Right now, it's our fall fund drive, and we're asking people for support of a more monetary nature. You know, why is supporting Jefferson Public Radio important?
Well, I think it's, like you said, we're trying to keep going and to keep growing like the Youth Mental Health Corps. As everyone probably knows, we recently had our federal funding cut. And so we're trying to not only sustain the work that we are doing without that federal funding, but also trying to create a new sustainable business model so we can continue to exist into the future without that federal funding. And again, we really think and hope that you agree that JPR is such an essential service to have in our region, whether you like listening to our news, listening to us talk on the debrief, or the music side of things, classics, the live sessions. We have so many services that we provide, and now is the time to donate and support that, because it really is up to us at this point. You can give us a call at 888-552-6191 or go online to donate at ijpr.org/support.
And Justin, we're looking for 150 new contributors. Why are new members to JPR important?
Well, yeah. Well, local news is really important, not just for the local region, actually, but I think for the country. You know, I think a lot of important stories start on the local level and are picked up nationally. So what happens here is really important for what happens, I think, in the entire country. And so that's why I think people should consider the value of our station and the news we produce.
And they could do that by giving us a call, 888-552-6191, or go to ijpr.org/support, or just click the orange donate button on ijpr.org. Well, that's it for the debrief this week. Thanks so much for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.